From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Richard Engel was the only American TV correspondent who remained in Baghdad through the shock and awe bombing campaign. He reported live day and night on ABC TV. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about his new memoir, A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, on the ground in Baghdad before, during, and after the war. He now reports from Iraq for NBC News. Also, the life of Martin Luther, one of the leaders of the Protestant Reformation. We talk with religion historian Martin Marty about his new biography of Luther. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new DVD of the movie musical My Fair Lady. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush says he supports amending the U.S. Constitution to ban gay marriage. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
President Bush, citing recent events in San Francisco, where more than 3,000 same-sex couples have been married this month, and Massachusetts, where the state Supreme Court has ruled that gay couples have the right to marry, said that marriage between a man and a woman must be protected or society will suffer.
Ages of experience have taught humanity that the commitment of a husband and wife to love and to serve one another promotes the welfare of children and the stability of society.
He called on Congress to enact the amendment. A two-thirds vote of approval is needed in each chamber. It would then go to the states, where 38 of them would have to ratify the amendment. The issue has become prominent this election year, with the president's conservative supporters urging him to take this stand. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Opposition groups in Haiti have rejected a U.S.-backed peace plan because it fails to call for the resignation of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Aristide called on the international community today to help his government keep the rebels from capturing Haiti's capital city, Port-au-Prince. He said that if rebels take over the capital, thousands of people will be killed and thousands more will be forced to become refugees. The Pentagon says it has charged two men who are suspected of having strong links to Osama bin Laden with conspiracy to commit war crimes. The men will now stand trial before a military commission. It'll be the first time military tribunals will be convened since the end of World War II. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
The Pentagon says Ibrahim al-Qusi of Sudan and Ali al-Balul, a Yemeni national, are alleged to have, among other things, conspired with Osama bin Laden to attack civilians and carry out other forms of terrorism. The Pentagon says al-Balul is also alleged to have produced videos that glorified the murder of Americans, which would then be used as recruitment tools. Al-Qusi is suspected of being a key accountant within al-Qaeda. These are the first charges to be laid against any of the approximately 650 detainees at a U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The two have the right to defense counsel, both military and civilian. But tribunal critics say the rules of evidence are weighted in favor of the government. It's unclear when the trials will begin. Jackie Northam, NPR News, Washington.
The lawyer for Martha Stewart says the home decorating guru will not testify in her own defense at her trial for insider stock trading and obstruction of justice. Defense attorneys are expected to conclude their arguments in the case within the next day or so. In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 43 points to close at 10,566. The Nasdaq was down 2 points. It closed at 2,005. This is NPR News. Today's presidential primary in Utah has been largely overlooked by the candidates. Both John Kerry and John Edwards are focusing their attention on next week's Super Tuesday contests. But that hasn't dampened the enthusiasm of many voters in Utah. KUER's Michael Havey in Salt Lake City reports.
Democrats are in the minority in Utah and have been feeling a little overlooked. Dennis Kucinich is the only candidate who's come to Utah, but voters haven't been ignoring today's primary. Turnout so far has been strong in this largely conservative state. Shortly after polls opened, a long line of voters stretched from Salt Lake City's main polling site. The primary is open to all state residents, though they're supposed to declare themselves Democrats. Utah Democratic Party Chair Donald Dunn says they're aiming for record turnout.
It's it's still early in the voting, but all over the state we had a call from St. George that the wait was a half an hour, and people in line were chit-chatting with each other that the sentiment was really anybody but Bush.
Utah's primary only has 23 delegates at stake compared to more than 1,100 up for grabs in 10 states next week. For NPR News, I'm Michael Havey in Salt Lake City.
The Senate refused today to pass a bill limiting the amount of damages in medical malpractice cases. Republicans fell 12 votes short of the number needed to force the Senate to consider the measure. Backers of the bill say it's a key factor in the high cost of health care. They say that multi-million-dollar lawsuits against doctors and hospitals have forced up the cost of medical malpractice insurance. Democrats say the bill's supporters are just using the issue for political gain. They say there's no evidence that limiting the amount of damages would help control insurance costs. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university offering a master's in business administration online at capella.edu.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When American TV networks pulled their reporters out of Baghdad 1 year ago before the bombing began, freelance journalist Richard Engel stayed. He was the only American TV correspondent to remain in Baghdad through the Shock and Awe campaign. He often reported live while the bombs were falling. There were times he reported through the day and the night, living on what he describes as adrenaline and buzz. Engel is still reporting in Iraq, now as a correspondent for NBC News. He's briefly in the U.S. for the publication of his new memoir, A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, on the ground in Baghdad before, during, and after the war. Engel has been covering the Middle East since 1996 and taught himself to speak Arabic. He's reported for the BBC, Voice of America, and the public radio program The World. He's also edited English-language publications in Cairo and Jerusalem. But when he went to Iraq before the war, he wasn't able to use his credentials as a journalist to enter the country.
During the build-up to the war, the Iraqi regime became very strict about the number of visas that it was issuing for journalists. And I was a journalist at the time, but I couldn't obtain a reporting visa. The major networks were only given one or sometimes two visas each. And so agencies like CNN or BBC were saving those prized visas for their star correspondents. And I was a freelance journalist at the time, working for public radio and working for ABC. So I wasn't on the top of the list, or not anywhere near the list, to receive one of those coveted visas. So I was determined to get in and into Iraq and cover this conflict. So I actually got a human shield visa. These were issued by the Iraqi government for people who wanted to go to Iraq and express solidarity with the government and tie themselves to oil refineries and things like that. And so I was able to get in using this guise, and then I was hoping once I got there to try and convert it into a reporting visa. And it was after a long time and having to leave the country and going from one place to another and then eventually come back, I did in the end manage to secure the proper credentials.
Was there ever a point where you expected to play the part of the human shield?
No, I had no intention of being a human shield. I hoped that would just get me in the door. And then once I was on the inside, I would be able to secure a reporting visa. I didn't ever want to be a human shield. I didn't want to make a documentary or any kind of... I wanted to do normal news coverage. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to do that unless I had the proper credentials, because the way the system was set up at the time, every time you left the hotel where you were staying, which you had to register with local authorities, you were required to go with a minder. So as a foreigner, I wouldn't have been able to walk around very easily and have done reporting without... I did some of that, but it was very difficult under the old system to have done any kind of reporting without the proper credentials. And then I certainly would have looked like a spy, and then I would have been arrested or killed. And it was a road I didn't want to go down.
What was it like for you when most of the American journalists were leaving Iraq and you were staying?
I was very worried. I thought, do they know something that I don't know? Am I making the right decision? Am I being a cowboy, as it's sometimes referred to? Not everyone did leave, but most, there was a mass exodus. I think there were about 600 journalists who were there in Baghdad in the immediate buildup to the war. A lot of them were from radio and print and the whole television crews and producers and correspondents and things like that. And then in the very end, I think there was only about maybe less than 100. And the biggest exodus was from the major networks, the television, people who made a decision that it just wasn't worth the risk. And there was significant danger. And so when I was there watching people leave, I was wondering if they were making the right decision. But I felt somewhat more comfortable than some of the other people that were there at the time. I've spent a lot of time in the Middle East. It's now about 8 years that I've been in the region. And I speak Arabic, and I knew Iraq. I'd been there on previous visits. I was a one-man band, so I felt that I could, if the situation got very much out of hand, I could go underground. And there were many people I found who exhibited really exceptional, many Iraqis who exhibited exceptional bravery and would have, I think, sheltered me and helped me out if the situation, if the authorities decided to round up all of the Westerners in the country, or if there was riots that broke out, or if the bombing became so intense that there was no safe place to be. So I felt somewhat comfortable and didn't think I was really risking my life too much.
How did it make you feel knowing that, you know, ABC and the other TV networks had sent their reporters home, but, you know, they were happy to use you if you were willing to risk your life after they sent their reporters home?
Well, I didn't feel exploited in any way. This was something I wanted to do, and they were actually very, very fair with me about that. They told me clearly, we are not telling you or requiring you to be there in any way, and they said that they would have certainly helped me to leave at any stage, and I was in contact with them throughout, and I felt comfortable. It was my decision, and I never was pressured in any way to make it one way or another, but I did feel more comfortable by having more knowledge of the area and being able to move around more or less discreetly. I only had my own little DV, it's a digital video camera, and local people who were helping me to get around, local drivers and fixers. And I built up my own network of people. And this is another thing that I spent a lot of time doing, was working on establishing the right safe houses, the right drivers. At one stage, I had cars parked all over the city, and I told some of them, just keep them running because I never know where I might end up. And I spent a lot of time trying to get people to fix up their own cars so that if I needed to make a getaway, that I would make sure they had gas in it, that they had extra tires, that I had hotel rooms all across the city that had generators and food and crowbars in them. So I really established myself a little safety net. So I felt that I was relying on myself more than anyone else. So I felt somewhat comfortable about it.
Can I point out that this kind of safety net is kind of like a cottage industry, because you basically have to pay everybody as part of this safety net. You know, pay them for their services. In some cases, it's more of a bribe. You had, what, $20,000 taped to your ankle?
I had $20,000 with me at almost all times. And I spent a lot of it. I think I spent about $10,000 just keeping this system going. You know, I didn't think this was the right time to be a cheapskate. So I was spending, you know, if car repairs for one of these guys would end up costing $75 and he was charging me $125, I wasn't going to really negotiate too much, because these were people who I was putting my life in their hands. So yes, I was paying people for their services to help me out, to drive me to places, to hire people, to be there if I needed them. So I had a lot of redundancy. For example, I was staying in the Palestine. Every day, there was a guy who came and cleaned the floor, cleaned the room, all of the rooms on the floor where I was staying, I should say. Every day I saw him, I gave him $20. He didn't do anything. He didn't come. He didn't clean the room. I gave him $20 just because if something was going on in the hotel, the authorities were coming, I assumed he would be the first to know, and I wanted my room to be the first one he knocked on. So it does cost a little bit of money.
Well, two questions for you. Where did the $20,000 come from? Was it an advance from a network, or was it just like your savings that you brought with you? And the second part of that question is, how do you wrap that much money around your ankle? That's a lot of money. And you can't exactly have $1,000 bills with you.
No, but some of it was an advance from the radio station, The World, which is a public radio station that I was working for, and some of it was my own money. And I kept it in $100 bills in one of these travel sleeves that they sell. And it looks like an ace bandage with a pouch on each side of it. And it was pretty bulky, but at the bottom of your pants, I was usually wearing jeans or khaki pants, there's a little bit of extra room, and you don't notice it so much.
When word gets around that you have that much money, aren't you targeted by people who would be happy to steal it from you?
Well, I made sure that word never got around. I kept most of it in there, but I never told anyone, not even the people who I was who were around me, that I had this money. I would keep an extra grand, or I would keep at least $500 in my wallet. So if I ever needed to pay somebody, I would just pay it out of my wallet. And then if I ever needed to dip into my safety net, I would keep that around my I would do that in private. And I also had a money belt in it, with a zipper in the back. So, and I had money stashed away in some of the safe houses as well, hidden in places, because I thought, if I was ever in a bind, the easiest way to get out of it quickly was to have a couple $100 to give myself an extra 5 minutes, or to get those extra 3 feet to the door.
You mentioned you had a crowbar in your hotel room. What for?
Well, I had crowbars in hotel rooms all across across Baghdad, just in case you needed to. I thought if the door is locked on me from the outside, I could break the lock. Or if the room is damaged in such a way and the door jam shifts and the door becomes stuck, if I'm trapped under something, it's just a useful tool, a useful thing to have a big, sturdy piece of metal when you don't know what the situation is going to, what kind of situation you're going to be in.
My guest is Richard Engel. His new memoir is called A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, on the ground in Baghdad before, during, and after the war. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Richard Engel. He reports from Iraq for NBC News. During the bombing of Baghdad, he reported live for ABC. He was the only American TV correspondent who remained in Baghdad through the bombing campaign. Could you describe what the worst night of the bombing was like for you and where you were while it was happening?
I was on the 14th floor of the Palestine Hotel. I was on my balcony facing west, looking out over the Tigris River. And I was looking at the grounds of the Republican Palace, which was Saddam Hussein's main headquarters in Iraq, in Baghdad anyway. And the bombs began most of the time. They were for the first two nights. They had begun around 2 a.m. Or 3 a.m. They began at a similar time on that third night, but the intensity picked up like it hadn't done previously. And then the sky was just yellow with all of the fireballs that were exploding, mainly clustered around this palace compound, which was right across the river from me. And it was like thunder, claps of thunder one after another, and the windows were shaking and the building was swaying. It was like an earthquake almost. And some of the blasts were so close that they would push me back and send my hair blowing backwards like I had my face in front of a hot hair dryer. So it was really a terrifying night. And then waking up in the morning and looking out over the balcony and seeing the city still seemed intact, but I didn't know what to do. You go outside and you don't know if the city's even still standing. We were very cut off from information. So I didn't know if I was going to go outside and find that Baghdad looked like the surface of the moon, and that people were going to be, you know, angry and rioting. And as an American wandering around this city, what do I tell people when I see them on the street? So getting out and wandering around very nervously or sheepishly the next morning was also a unique experience.
Were you conscious of trying to not look afraid?
No, I didn't. I was, most of the time when I was on air, I was just running on adrenaline. So I was just trying to get the words out and to try and be there on time. If we were in continuous coverage, so it was hard enough to just make sure you had all of the live shots. But then I also had to do reporting. I was the only person. I didn't have a producer who could go out and get elements for me or anybody like that. So I would finish with one program, tear off the mic and jump in a car and then try and gather elements. I was also filming things myself, so I had to gather elements, gather video, try and feed it out in time and then run back to be for the next broadcast. So I had to go out of the building as well so that I could have something to talk about. So most of the time I was so busy that I didn't really have time to think about too much. Well, okay, here I'm going to stand there. I'm going to look brave or anything like that. By the time I got to the live position, it was usually seconds before I was on air. So I was relieved, if anything, that I made it on time.
How did the eating problems, the sleeping problems, the horrible stuff from the fires and the bombing in the air, the stress, how did all of that, your lack of sleep, how did all of that affect your overall health and your ability to function, you know, well enough to perform?
Well, I was actually quite sick for the last, for the middle 10 days of the war. I was in an interview with, for example, with Tariq Aziz, and I had to call off the interview in the middle. I was coughing so badly. I started sweating. He was trying to give his answers, and I was just coughing and coughing. I couldn't stop myself. So at one stage, he offered me a glass of water, and I said, thank you very much. And then as he was leaving the room, I joked. I said, listen, I'm sorry if I got you sick. I'm an American biological weapon here. So I got sick because of the lack of sleep and running around.
And did you still report while you were that sick?
Yeah, of course. You know, the adrenaline is an amazing chemical. I think more research needs to be done. When you're totally flooded with adrenaline, you're on national TV and the war is going on, you can handle a lot of virus.
While you were in Baghdad, I think this was during the war, maybe it was right before the war, you came across DVDs that were being sold of tortures and executions, real ones, not staged ones. What was the source of those DVDs?
Yeah, all of this material came out after the war. This is all the stuff that had been taking place during the regime, and then suddenly when this the lid was taken off this boiling pot, all of the evil that had been going on behind closed doors came to the surface. So tapes started emerging that were from that had been taken by one of the many or many of the Iraqi security services. Some of them showed executions, particularly of Shiite Muslims during the Iran-Iraq war. There were other videos of amputations, or people who had been who'd upset one of the more senior officials like Uday or Hussein and Saddam Hussein, and they had videotaped the amputation of the hand, for example. Other times, I saw a tape of someone who had plastic explosive stuffed in his pocket and then was blown to bits. So there was lots of this. This was a regime, although it was disorganized on many levels, it was extremely keen on keeping files and keeping records of things, particularly video records. So there was lots of information that emerged after the regime. And then it was being sold openly on the streets because Iraqis themselves had heard about all these atrocities that were going on, and some Iraqis had experienced them themselves, and they wanted to, I think it was somewhat of a cathartic process for them to view these tapes and to buy these tapes and to sit around collectively and watch them and shake their heads at the in disgust at what had happened. So there's quite a bit of this material that has now emerged since the collapse.
Mm-hmm. And you got to see them?
Yeah, I saw them. I have a little bit of a sort of a morbid collection of all of these things that I, because you accumulate lots of stuff, and I think it's a good window into what the regime was like, and you can understand understand why these people, why the Iraqis are having such a tough time coming to terms with their past and with their future. There's a lot of healing that still needs to take place, and it's difficult to do that healing when they feel that they're still in this chaotic environment that they're in right now.
From what you've seen in Iraq, do you think that the end of the Saddam Hussein regime is decreasing the power of terrorist networks, or do you think it's attracting more terrorists and inspiring more would-be terrorists to become terrorists?
I think it's attracting. It's become a magnet for terrorists around the world, and has become a training ground, a proving ground for local terrorists to rise up. There has been some arguments that it's better to fight them in Iraq because, you know, you'll draw in all of the terrorists to Iraq and you can kill them there, so you don't have to fight them in New York or New Jersey or wherever. And that's what some of the local commanders in the U.S., the local U.S. commanders are telling the troops in Iraq. It is one theory, and maybe it will prove to be correct, but that assumes that there are a definable number of terrorists, that there's a finite number of people who want to fight against against Americans or American interests. One could just as easily argue that this situation in there and the chaos that's on the ground is attracting more and recruiting people who were never even considering this kind of behavior. So I think it's there are certainly more people from Al Qaeda and that kind of network in Iraq now than there ever were.
Why have you stayed in Iraq?
Well, I got a job that wants me to be there for one, and I think it's fascinating. I wouldn't feel satisfied at all if I had seen the old system as before, and then watch it get pulled down, and then to leave it mid mid story, as it would be. The story is not over yet, and I would there would be no satisfaction for me to leave and be like getting up in the middle of the movie. And it's a great movie.
Well, Richard Engel, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Richard Engel's new memoir is called A Fist in the Hornet's Nest, On the Ground in Baghdad Before, During, and After the War. He now reports for NBC News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting Tanner 88, an original series from creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau, tonight at 9 p.m. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Martin Luther wanted to reform the Catholic Church, but his excommunication led to the development of the Lutheran Church. Coming up, we talk with religion historian Martin Marty about his new biography of Luther. Also, Lord Schwartz reviews a new DVD of the movie My Fair Lady. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Luther was one of the leaders of the Protestant Reformation in Germany. After speaking out against corruption in the church and challenging the infallibility of the Pope, he was excommunicated in 1521. The Lutheran Church was developed around the principles he advocated. My guest Martin Marty has written a new biography of Martin Luther. Marty is a professor emeritus of religion at the University of Chicago. His honors include a National Book Award and the National Humanities Medal. Marty described Luther as a man of contradictions. Marty says that as much as any individual, Luther broke the hold of a single religion system and broke the boundaries set by religious elites. Yet he also stressed obedience to authority. I asked Martin Marty to describe how Martin Luther changed Christianity.
When Martin Luther came on the scene, there were people all over Europe who found abuses in the practices of the church headed at Rome by the Pope, and sometimes in the teachings. And they started trying to purify, to simplify, to reform, so that the, let's call it the channel of grace, by which people are made right with God would be pure and clear. And in the midst of all that, Martin Luther came along, a young monk, wrestling with his own demons, you might say, sure that he was offending God, unsure of whether he was going to be saved, and then reading the Bible in a certain way, he had it dawn on him that it's all free, it's all grace. And all these efforts to make you earn your way or buy your way were not only futile, but bad.
One of the things Martin Luther is best known for is nailing his 95 theses to a church door in 1517. And this was a kind of common thing in college. And he was in college then. Yes, that you would nail an argument to the door and then people would come and debate with you. So what he was doing was part of a standard practice, but the things he was saying were very atypical. He was opposing the selling of indulgences. What was the selling of indulgences?
The selling of indulgences was an invention, frankly a money-making invention, in which the individual who had felt guilty before God, who was sinful, who was sure that she had enraged a just God, and feared spending years in purgatory, an intermediate place of punishment, or eternity in hell, would be able to buy a way out of purgatory, lessen the threat, and so on. And so you simply had them printing out these little indulgence scripts, and depending on how much money you had and how anxious you were to invest, you got more and more years off that post-life punishment. And this, to Luther, violated the entire idea that God is a gracious God and that what God wants is not your pocketbook but your heart. So that's why he wrote that instead of buying indulgences, you should listen to the word of Jesus, who wanted the whole life to be one of repenting. I should say repenting didn't mean grimness. In his New Testament, repenting was also a joyful act. And everything about the indulgence system ran against that notion.
Luther wanted individuals to have a more direct and personal relationship to God. What made him think that people shouldn't need an intermediary of a priest in order to communicate with God?
For one thing, because he was so devoted to the Bible and so sure that it would make its point, he went back to Jesus, and he found there that Jesus was constantly opposed to the formal religious system. He was critical of the priests, the elders, the scribes, the rulers, and his reform was entirely to help people have a direct relation to God. He teaches them in the Gospels the prayer that we call the Our Father. He didn't like it that you had to bring a lamb for a sacrifice, or even two turtle doves, as Mary and Joseph did when they brought him, that had to be removed. There'd be no interruption in the transaction. Now, he was not, as he's often portrayed, a lonely kind of Robinson Crusoe of the faith. He wasn't an individualist who said you didn't have or need company. He was very churchly, and in my own interpretation, he kept wanting to be Catholic of a sort. In fact, he once said, the more you can celebrate communion as if it's in the upper room where Jesus and the disciples had the first one such meal, according to the Gospels, the better it will be.
In Luther's time, many priests and nuns were priests and nuns against their will. They took their vows and they couldn't leave. And they were forced to stay in that position. Were many men and women almost forced to be priests and nuns against their will?
I think more people were forced to be monks, friars, and nuns than priests. Priest was in public life, and you could get away if you wanted to. You were secular, they say, meaning out in the streets, out in the public realm. Whereas the monks and the nuns were cloistered, they were set apart. Sometimes a girl age 14 would be sent to a religious order in which she says goodbye to her parents, never leaves all her life, and they never see her again. On an annual visit, they might see her through a screen and so on. Well, if you're a 14-year-old girl and you're forced into that as opposed to choosing it, as some do even today, a joyful choice. Now, if you're forced into it and then everything happens, restlessness, your sexual juices are flowing, your dreams of an outer world are there, and you're all ready to go. So when someone comes along who, in Luther's case, a man with a deliverer of herring, of fish, goes to the Nimshin Monastery, convent, and puts nuns in the stinking fish barrels and runs them out at night. These are the set of people that Luther then had to find husbands for because they were abjectly poor.
So you're saying that Luther helped to free nuns in convents with the help of this a fish seller who would hide the nuns in his barrels?
At least in this one case. Others helped others escape, but the one that is important for him is that he finally ended up marrying one of those people who escaped in the fish barrels, Catherine von Bora. But that's typical. It was very hard. You were almost penalized for life by being in there. And many people took to it and liked it. Many people stayed because there was no choice. You didn't have any money. Your family had moved on and abandoned. And so you stay there, and there's a certain comfort to that. So I wouldn't want to portray it that everybody wanted to get out of it. There are things in the monastic life that Luther admired. He liked the scholarship of some of the monks. He liked the works of charity. He only thought they shouldn't have to make a lifelong vow. If they did it voluntarily, that would not have bothered him. But if they went in with that vow and the notion that by becoming a nun or a monk, you helped earn your way into God's grace, that's where he did his attack.
My guest is Martin Marty, a professor emeritus of religion at the University of Chicago. He's written a new biography of Martin Luther. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Martin Marty, and his new book is a biography of Martin Luther. It's part of the Penguin Lives series. So here's Martin Luther challenging the selling of indulgences, challenging some of the roles of priests and nuns. He even went so far as to challenge the Pope himself. What did Luther object to about papal power?
He objected, first of all, that what should be spiritual power was worldly. He didn't think that somebody who was called a vicar of Christ, a deputy for Christ, should be carrying the sword. Jesus was against that, and the Pope had armies. He was against the notion that the Pope could open the door of heaven and close the door of heaven. open the gates of hell and push you into it. No human being should do that. He was opposed to the corruption of contemporary popes, but that wasn't the biggest thing. Sometimes you'll see Luther portrayed as if he's so offended by corrupt popes. He knew a lot about human nature, and he knew there was corruption all over the place. It was the corruption of their teaching and their religious practice that bothered him. And when he saw the Pope making various alliances, one day with the King of France, one day with the Holy Roman Emperor in Germany and Spain, these alliances were all to gain worldly power, and he thought it should be a spiritual power and a depth that would reach the heart as opposed to force one into prisons and into subjection.
What did the Pope want to do to punish Martin Luther for taking a stand against the selling of indulgences, for wanting to allow priests to allow monks and nuns to leave the monastery, and for wanting to diminish the powers of the Pope?
The Pope first threatened and then excommunicated Luther, which meant put him outside the church, and that didn't mean a death sentence. That meant you lost all kinds of legal privileges and so on. It was very low status. But then at numbers of imperial gatherings, it came to the point finally where Luther was what would be the equivalent of subversive, traitor, and that he did in effect have a death sentence for most of his adult years. There were times when he had to be hidden. He was hidden in a castle called the Wartburg, hidden by his friends for a period of time. He didn't go to the most important meeting of the new young Lutheran movement at Augsburg, because that would have been dangerous. That's where it's in front of the emperor. But the key point, earlier on you mentioned the thing everyone knows about Luther, the 95 Theses. The other thing that everybody knows is when church and state, as we call it today, when religion and regime, when pope and emperor are in combination, Luther's trapped there. And at Worms, Cathedral City, they piled up all of his writings, and the papal delegate asked him, are these yours? And Luther looked at the monster's pile. Yeah, they are his. Well, will you recant? Will you reject them? And Luther said, well, I can't. For one thing, a lot of them are irrelevant. They're not about the topics we're debating. Others are just repeating what's in the Bible, and I can't recant the Bible. Give me overnight to think. And the next day he stands in front of the emperor and says, I can't take these back unless I'm convinced by scripture and sound reason. I can't take them back. And then some people hear him say his most famous line, here I stand, I can do no other, God help me. When Lutherans like to do kitsch objects, you know, they have Lutheran beer mugs and they have Lutheran bobbleheads, and somebody sent me some socks that say, here I stand, I can do no other. So, but that was really defiance. That's as if you're taking on the highest civil authority in Europe, namely the emperor, who has all kinds of backing, and it took great courage. It's right after that his friends spirited him away. He had been given safe conduct to that event, but when that ran out, he certainly would have been killed had he not been protected by Prince Frederick the Wise.
Martin Luther had so many differences with the church. Why did he want to become a priest in the first place?
When he wanted to become a priest, it came out of a deep conviction. Very first thing, he was a monk before he was a priest, and he was a very troubled soul. He once said that the trembling of a leaf, the crackling of a twig, would throw his heart into his mouth. He really feared he was guilty. We have pictures of...
Guilty?
Guilty before God, a bad sin. And one time he'd been visiting his parents, and on the way back to the university, there is a terrible lightning bolt near him, and he's thrown to the ground, and he prays to St. Anne, who was the patron saint of miners, M-I-N-E-R-S. His father was a miner. Blessed St. Anne, if you spare me, I will become a monk. This enraged his father, who wanted Luther to be an attorney. A lawyer was a good life insurance for father and mother when they got old. He was just infuriated. But Luther said, I made that vow, and he went. He became a very serious monk. He was picked out by a good talent scout, my favorite Catholic of the era, Johann von Staupitz, who sensed that Luther had scholarship in him. He thought Luther was way too scrupulous in finding faults. If I'm allowed to say it here, he said, "Luther, you keep me with 6 hours of confession as if calling every fart a sin." That's a language that was very common in confessional language if you look it up at the time. And Staupitz said, "That's not what it's about. This is about God's good grace to you." So Luther is torn in all that, but along the way wants to be ordained because then he gets to hold the very body of Jesus and the very blood of Jesus, the bread and the wine, and give it to people and help impart eternal life. When he finally got to do it, he almost fainted, went into shock to think that he was holding the body of Christ. It was that vivid to people in that day. And so he enjoyed that once he got used to it very much. He liked being a preacher, a pastor, a priest.
But he also had grave doubts.
It's impossible to separate Luther from his faith and impossible to separate him from his doubts. He really acted as if the two always belonged together. He had a concept, the only word I don't translate in the whole book, because you can't, it's called Anfechtungen, which meant an agony of doubt, which didn't come from your brain, your reason, your experience. It didn't come from what he usually said were your enemies, the attractive world, the devil, your own person. He thought that somehow God was abandoning himself and every believer somewhere along the way. And he would writhe in the night at first until he finally came to that point that God's grace reaches you precisely at such moments and lifts you up. But that didn't mean he was cured of it. And one of the tutors of his children, George Weller, had what today we would call manifest clinical depression. What should he do? Well, Luther says, you've got Anfechtung and you have to fight it off. What are the weaponry? The Word of God, God's grace. But also in the world, go dancing, gamble a little bit, drink some beer, do anything except overt sin. And Luther himself said, when I had Anfechtung, and sometimes I'd reach over and hold my wife in the middle of the night.
Martin Luther's life is filled with contradictions, many of which you point out through your book. And one of those contradictions is that although he wanted Christians to have a more direct relationship with God, he wanted to eliminate a lot of the hierarchy and special privileges of the clergy. You couldn't exactly call him the most open-minded egalitarian either. He condemned the Jews toward the end of his life. What was his problem with the Jews?
His problem with the Jews, which is, I think, the saddest chapter in his life, and there's no way you can defend one line of it, was that as a young person, he was close to them. Translating the Bible, he would go to Jews to learn what this part of the animal being sacrificed was in Hebrew and in German. He grew up with them, and he was really convinced that once the gospel got out, they would all be converted. This would be a real sign. They'd all turn Christian. And, of course, almost none of them did. And then as life went on for him, they almost became the test. He was not anti-Semitic in the sense of racial anti-Semitism of the kind that ruins the modern world. He was a religious anti-Semite, which might have been worse in the language of that day. His attacks were always on the rabbis. They were the ones who could have taught the Jews the gospel, and they didn't. So when he says, you have to burn the synagogues and burn the rabbis' houses, he's not out for the massacre of all the Jews, but he does want to cut off the teaching.
Do you think Martin Luther would be shocked if he could come back today to see how many denominations there are within Christianity?
He probably would be shocked because anybody who knows there are 25,000 of them would be shocked themselves. I think he had to know that he was letting something loose that would mean a good deal more diversity. And if you have freedom, you're going to have choice and you'll have a lot more. But I don't think he could have envisioned or could welcome the great diversity. He believed he would be, in the end, an agent of Christian unity. And I think he would have smiled in 1999 when the Lutherans of the Lutheran World Federation and the Vatican signed a joint document saying most of the things they fought over about grace 5 centuries ago, they now agree on.
Well, Martin Marty, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Martin Marty's new book, Martin Luther, is part of the Penguin Live series. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new DVD of the movie My Fair Lady. This is Fresh Air. It's Oscar time, and in honor of the Academy Awards, Warner Brothers has released on DVD a number of classic Oscar-winning movies. One of them, My Fair Lady, has an intriguing backstory, as music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us.
My Fair Lady, one of Broadway's most successful musicals, went on to become one of Hollywood's most successful movies. In 1964, it won 8 Oscars, including the awards for Best Actor, Best Director, and Best Picture. Warner Brothers has just put out a new 2-disc special edition DVD in a gorgeous new high-definition transfer to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the film's original release. The most interesting added material on this set is an unusually honest hour-long documentary about the making of the movie, narrated by Jeremy Brett, the actor who played the role of Freddie. It's hard to imagine a less controversial film than My Fair Lady, and yet there's a continuing controversy about the casting of the title role. On Broadway, Eliza Doolittle, the Cockney flower seller whom linguistics professor Henry Higgins transforms into an elegant lady, was played by a young English woman who had only one previous Broadway credit. I'm referring, of course, to Julie Andrews. She not only had a lovely, silvery voice, but she also brought a certain wistful poignance to the role that no one else has ever quite matched. On a DVD of musical comedy clips from The Ed Sullivan Show, called Best of Broadway Musicals, you can see how magical she was, singing and dancing Wouldn't It Be Loverly with members of the Broadway cast.
All I want is a room somewhere, far away from the cold night air, with one enormous chair. Chocolate for me to eat, lots of coal making lots of heat, warm face, warm hands, warm feet, and wouldn't it be lovely?
Two of the show's leading players, Rex Harrison and Stanley Holloway, repeated their roles in the film, but typically Hollywood wanted a more established star for the title role, Audrey Hepburn, who was also wonderful, especially in the later scenes of her transformation. But she wasn't considered a singer, so the Hollywood pros did what they usually did with movie stars who couldn't sing. They brought in someone else to dub her singing voice. That uncredited singer was soprano Marnie Nixon, who also dubbed the singing voices of Deborah Carr in The King and I and Natalie Wood in West Side Story. According to Jeremy Brett in the documentary, Hepburn was desperate to do her own singing, as was Brett himself, whose singing voice was dubbed for On the Street Where You Live. Two songs, Wouldn't It Be Loverly and Show Me, were actually filmed with Hepburn lip-syncing to her own recorded voice. Later, her vocal tracks were replaced by Marnie Nixon's. These outtakes with Audrey Hepburn's own singing have been located and are included on the DVD. You can see on her face the expressions you hear in her voice, a voice that gave these songs a dimension of character missing from the final version of the film.
Lots of chocolate for me to eat. Lots of cow, Mike, lots of ink. Warm face, warm hands, warm feet. How wouldn't it be lovely? Oh, so lovely, sitting absolutely still. I would never budge till spring. Crept over the windowsill, some.
Marnie Nixon's pleasant but generic singing erases Hepburn's inimitable and irresistible vocal personality.
Lots of chocolate for me to eat. Lots of cow, Mike, and lots of eat. Warm face, warm hands, warm feet. Oh, wouldn't it be lovely?
Audrey Hepburn was one of the few people connected with My Fair Lady who wasn't even nominated for an Academy Award, maybe because she didn't do her own singing. And that year, the Best Actress Oscar went to the star of Mary Poppins, Julie Andrews.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new DVD edition of My Fair Lady. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Anne-Marie Baldonado. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Toyota and the next generation Prius, featuring hybrid synergy drive, committed to the quality of the air as well as the airwaves. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Waters. His movies like Pink Flamingos and Hairspray have made him one of the eccentric heroes of the independent film world. This weekend, he hosts the Independent Spirit Awards, and he has a new book of his film photos, which are also on exhibit in New York. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.